Hello, everyone, and thank you once again for listening to the Saga of World War II, a Casus Belli project. Today, my guest is Simon Reed, author of The Iron Sea, How the Allies Hunted and Destroyed Hitler's Warships from Hatchet Books. This book details the efforts made by the Allies to sink the Kriegsmarine's major surface combatants, namely the Bismarck, Tirpitz, Knysenau, and the Scharnhorst. Stories range from bombing missions over France and Norway to the epic battle between the HMS Hood and the Bismarck. Anyone who is familiar with the broad strokes of the Second World War is familiar with the sinking of the Bismarck, but most of the other events recounted were new to me, most especially the raid on Saint-Nazaire on the Atlantic coast of France. Many of these stories I cover only briefly in the show, or will cover briefly, but the Iron Sea details them with a real eye for the individual experiences of those involved. This is the type of book I really love to include because it fills in so many gaps that I leave in my show. I try to paint a big picture, but leave out a lot of the nitty-gritty detail, especially when it comes to personal experiences of those who actually fought in the war. This book gives a very foxhole level, or maybe gunport level, view of that war. I also think it gives a good idea of what the war was like for a sailor or airman. It's easy for most people to imagine the war for an infantryman, but for some reason, a sailor's experiences seem harder to conceptualize, I think. I really enjoyed the book and had a great conversation with the author. I felt like I could have gone on all afternoon talking with him about the war and ships, but alas, I was recording an episode and needed to keep things relevant. Anyway, let's begin Appendix F, The Iron Sea, an interview with Simon Reed. Okay, so to get started, Simon, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here, Sean.
So overall, just to kind of cover the book in a nutshell, I think we start with, covers the battle to sink the Bismarck, the RAF bombing campaign to disable the German fleet at anchor in France, the Channel Dash, Operation Cherubus to get the Scharnhorst and Knysenau back to German home waters, Operation Chariot, which is the raid on Saint-Nazaire, the Battle of the North Cape when Scharnhorst battled the Prince of Wales in the Arctic, and finally, Operation Catechism to sink the Tirpitz, which, when I list it all out like that, actually sounds like this book should be, you know, 800 pages long, but it's actually a pretty reasonable, about 250?
Yeah, I think it's 286 pages of text, and then the rest is all, sort of endnotes and bibliography. And that was kind of my intention, actually. When I sat down to write this book, I knew there were going to be a lot of sort of action scenes, so to speak. And although it's a work of nonfiction, obviously, it's a work of military history, I actually think of it more as a true action adventure story. And I am a big fan of sort of like the summer Hollywood blockbuster type of movies where
I can definitely tell from the way you wrote it that it almost
exactly
reads like fiction.
Yeah, you know, where there's a strong storyline, but you don't have to wait too long between the explosions. And that was sort of my intent with The Iron Sea. I wanted it to sort of be a book that you could read sitting on the beach. You know, not that many people, you know, have been traveling lately, but that was the intent. So, you know, the book doesn't go into a lot of sort of technical detail about the ships themselves. It's more about the battles and the human drama and sort of the danger that these ships pose to the Allied war effort. But I wanted it to sort of move along with the velocity of a bullet, you know, something that really kept the pages turning.
Yeah, and that definitely comes across. I mean, there's definitely a style of writing where you could have covered the same exact information, but in a much more, especially it being a naval-themed book, you know, it could be very much, you know, bearings and headings and, you know, knots, but it doesn't come across that way at all. It's definitely action-packed.
And that was intentional. You know, when you read the, the official battle reports and, the war diaries, there is a lot of, you know, we aimed the guns 12 degrees and, you know, we steered the ship 12 degrees starboard. And I just thought, let's get all this stuff out of it and let's just, you know, everyday language that people can understand and just focus on sort of the exciting bits, as it were. I was actually kind of influenced in the writing of the book by Christopher Nolan's film Dunkirk.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, and you know, I went to see that movie just as I started writing Iron Sea, and I love the way obviously he took a real event and he fictionalized it. Whereas the Iron Sea, it's not fictionalized; it's all, you know, real. But I love the way that Nolan sort of turned a piece of history into a survival story, and you know, sort of like a survival thriller. And so that was the intent with the Iron Sea.
So I guess you've kind of leaned into it a little already, but could you just give us some information about your background and how you came to write this book, what your inspiration was for it?
Sure. My background is I am a journalist by trade. I've been writing books for about 15 years. Iron Sea is my ninth book. I've written several World War II books in the past, but this is my first book sort of focusing on naval warfare, and it was an accidental book. This wasn't the book I actually set out to write. Initially, I wanted to write a book on the raid on San Jose, Operation Chariot, and I started doing research for that. And as I was researching it, I realized there was kind of a larger story to be told about these four capital ships in the German fleet, because the efforts to sort of destroy all four of them, and you mentioned them, Bismarck, Tirpitz, Scharnhorst, and Eisenau, there was just a lot of human drama involved in all of it. And so the scope of the book expanded. But the nice thing is sort of all the stories are interrelated. So it was I was able to sort of kind of tell a connective narrative without sort of the efforts to sink these four ships being too disjointed in nature. And I'm happy with the way the book came out. My fascination with the World War II, I've always been focused on the air war. I'm British by birth. I moved to the U.S. when I was seven, but my grandfather was a telegunner in RAF Bomber Command. And after we moved to the U.S., we always used to fly back to England to spend the holidays with my grandparents in London. And on Christmas Day in England, they show the movie The Great Escape on television. It's a tradition there. I don't know why they choose Christmas, but that's it. And it was one of my grandfather's favorite movies. And when I was about 8 or 9, he sat me down to watch it with him. And I was immediately hooked, especially, you know, Steve McQueen jumping the barbed wire on his motorcycle. It just blew me away. And that is sort of what pulled me into World War II history and my fascination with the conflict. And it's been a constant ever since.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. My grandfather fought in the Pacific in the Second World War. And, you know, I never had the, you know, sit down on Christmas Day and watch the whatever movie with them experience. But, yeah, I think that for a lot of people is
it rubs off. Yeah, it rubs off on you. And, you know, my grandfather, he never talked about his experiences, but after he passed away when I was 15, I got his RAF logbook that detailed all his various operations. And that was sort of my first kind of glimpse into sort of firsthand accounts of World War II experiences. And that really then fueled my interest in the war. And it's, you know, it's an interest that hasn't eased up over the years.
Yeah, and I definitely appreciate something like this, and I like to include these sorts of things or books like this in my show because I give that very, I don't know, 30,000-foot view sometimes and cover all the broad strokes, but I very rarely get down into that sort of foxhole level or, I guess, in the case of this book, gunport level view of the war. And that sort of brings me to ask, you know, as someone who does like a history podcast, not for a living, but as a hobby, I guess you could say.
Sure.
I'm always interested in sources, and you got some very, you know, looks like journal entries from average sailors and airmen and officers on these vessels. Yeah. You know, kind of how did you find those, and then take that firsthand accounts and turn them into a narrative?
Sure. The first of all, let me say, you know, when you research a book like this, the internet is a wonderful, it's a wonderful thing. When I wrote my first book I ever wrote on World War II came out in the UK years ago, and it was about the RAF. And for that, I went to the Imperial War Museum in London and went through a lot of their archives for firsthand accounts. But the Imperial War Museum in the years since then has digitized a lot of their stuff. And so one of the main sources for the Iron Sea are the sound archives on the Imperial War website. And they're free to listen to. And if you just have a passing interest in the war and want to get some great firsthand experiences on what, you know, these men and women went through, you know, I recommend your listeners go out and check it out. And there are thousands of sound recordings on there. And, you know, obviously at this point, the thing with the Iron Sea is a lot of the participants are dead. They went down with the ships or they passed away from old age. So you do have to rely a lot on archival material. And so the first source were the sound archives. And, you know, one of the most compelling recordings that I listened to when writing this book are the recordings of Ted Briggs and Bob Tilburn, who were two of the survivors from HMS Hood. And their stories are just absolutely riveting. So that's one component. The second source of information were the British National Archives. You know, for all of these battles and operations, there are official reports. And what's amazing about them is the level of detail. They're not written in sort of, a lot of them aren't written in bureaucratic language. They read like a novel with a proper narrative flow and a plot. And usually there are appendices to these with firsthand accounts and battle reports from the participants. And so that was a great source of information. And the nice thing is, those operational reports, they give you the 30,000 foot view that you were just talking about. They give you the high level overview of everything that happened, so you can get the battle or the campaign down on paper. And then what you do is, once you sort of have the framework of the battle, or you know, like say the hunt for Bismarck after she sinks Hood. You get the basic framework of the hunt down and what happened. And then you go to your first-person sources, like the sound archives at the Imperial War Museum, or if you can get your hands on letters or journals, and you take the first-hand accounts out of there and you plug it into the framework, and you know, you sort of plug in the holes to create a full story. And the internet has made it very easy to do that, because a lot of archives now, you know, they've digitized everything. The British National Archives, their catalog is all online. So if you know what you're looking for, you can find it, and then you can put in a request, and they'll actually digitize records for you and email them to you. And it's a great way to research if you're sort of limited in your ability to travel, or, you know, you can't get to a location. So the internet is the researcher's friend. And then, you know, there are websites out there where people have posted letters from, you know, their grandparents and loved ones and that sort of thing that survived the war, and that can provide good background information. The BBC had a great website up, and I don't know if it's still up, but it was called The People's War. And that was a collection of firsthand experiences from people who had survived, you know, the Battle of North Cape, where the Scharnhorst sunk. Firsthand accounts from the Blitz. There was an account there from the Battle of the Barents Sea, which features in the book, which I use. So if you sort of know where to look, you can find these resources. And the firsthand accounts are what make the book. You know, military history, I love it, but you know, let's be honest, some books can be very dry.
Yeah.
Some books are all about sort of the strategy and tactics, and there's a place for that, obviously. And but that's not my bag, right? I'm more into the firsthand accounts and the drama and sort of having a mix of the two. You know, you sort of want some of the strategy in there, but I think what really drives home the power of the war and sort of the horrific nature, obviously, are the words of the people who lived through it. And not just on the Allied side. You know, I made an attempt also to include firsthand accounts from the German side.
Yeah, as well. I mean, I definitely appreciate that, especially since it's very easy to just use nothing but English language sources, because there's so many of them available to us.
Yeah, and you know, I think the importance to it's very easy, I think, when you write about World War II or any conflict really, to paint in shades of black and white. You have the good guys, and you have the bad guys, and that's it. And you know, the one thing in writing the Iron Sea, the one thing you see is the respect that British and German naval personnel had for one another, and strangely enough, the empathy they had for one another. In every battle I write about in this book, at some point in the you know, post-operational report that, you know, the commanders type up, there is a reference to either how brave the Germans fought and you know, the empathy they felt when, you know, when Bismarck went down, and on the German side, there's always some comment about, you know, the bravery with which the British fought and how horrible it was to see, you know, the British ship go down, knowing that there were men on board going beneath the waves. And, you know, I think sometimes that sort of sympathetic view can get lost, you know, when you care about trying to create an exciting narrative with a lot of explosions and guns blowing up, you know, guns blowing up, that sort of thing. It can get easy to sort of overlook the human element, sort of the human compassion.
Yeah, and I think it kind of gives an idea of, you know, we see everything that happens during the action, but it gives an idea of what the aftermath was, seeing the mm-hmm. perspectives.
Yeah, absolutely. One moment that I found particularly touching is when, you know, Hood and Bismarck face off. And, you know, when you're talking about the Second World War, the clash between Hood and Bismarck, it's one of these iconic naval clashes. I mean, it only lasts 6 minutes, right? From the moment Hood fires her opening salvo at Bismarck, you know, it takes 6 minutes for Bismarck to sink Hood, but it leaves, you know, the Hood is the pride of the British Royal Navy, and her sinking leaves this, it inflicts a very deep psychological wound on the British public. But at the moment Hood blows up, one of the navigator assistants on Bismarck is actually looking at Hood through his viewfinder, and he witnesses Hood exploding. And even though, you know, they're like 20,000 yards apart, whatever it is, you know, he wrote afterwards that he felt the explosion in every nerve of his body. And he writes, you know, my one wish is that our children never have to go through anything like this again. And, you know, I think moments like that are important because, again, it captures the humanity, and it really drives home the tragedy of, you know, of what happened.
Yeah, and especially with something like the naval war, the air war, where I think it's pretty easy for the average person to imagine what it's like to be in the shoes of, say, an infantryman. You know, it's basically being in the woods, but you got to dig a hole and shoot guns at each other. And as an infantryman, I guess I can say that's more or less what it is. But it's always harder to conceptualize what the war was for a sailor, and those depicting those experiences, I think at least I have a better idea now of, okay, this is what it meant to be a sailor on something like, you know, on the Hood or on one of those smaller motorboats with machine guns mounted on them, or a destroyer or something that, yeah, a lot of the time they also are bored and probably sitting at sea looking at nothing. But during those brief moments when you're actually in contact shooting at one another, you know, it's still just as terrifying and just as, I'm not even sure what the word for it is.
Well, you know, the word is claustrophobic, I think, because when I started writing the book, I sort of wondered the same thing. You know, is there going to be drama here? I did not realize until I'd started really digging deep into the research how, when you think of naval warfare, right, you think of two battleships, you know, separated by thousands of yards in open sea, slugging it out. It's kind of impersonal. You know, you don't think there's sort of like a personal aspect to it, but that's totally incorrect. You know, these ships, for the men on them, although these ships are massive, there's nowhere really for them to run, right? It's a claustrophobic confine. You know, these shells, 15-inch shells, when they hurtle towards the ship, in more than one, you know, piece of documentation I came across, the sound of a naval shell approaching was always compared to the sound of an approaching freight train. You know, it's this loud screaming, whistling noise. And there was always this horrible tension just before impact of, you know, where is this thing going to land? And there's nowhere you can hide. And again, there was awareness on both sides that these men were fighting men just like themselves. When Bismarck goes down, you know, there's cheering on the British ships. But then on one boat, the men stop cheering because they realize, hey, wait a minute, you know what? These are guys with, you know, mothers waiting at home and wives and children just like this, just like us. And that could very well be us in the water. And so sort of naval combat, there's a closeness to it that I wasn't anticipating when I started writing the book. And that's one thing that I tried to get across in, you know, in the story. It's not just machines hammering each other into submission. You know, it's men doing it, but men who don't necessarily want to. It's just, they're just fighting for survival.
Yeah, I think, and there are a few very visceral depictions of it, I guess you could say, within the book. I think the raid on St. Nazaire has some, as well as basically any time there's aircraft and anti-aircraft gunners engaging each other, it seems they seem to describe that they could see the remains of men and blood scattered across the ships, or, you know, if a shell tore through the bridge or something, and just what's left behind is devastation.
And that was the other thing. It was gruesome. It's stupid to say, I didn't think naval combat was as gruesome as this. But again, you know, I think when we think of naval combat, we think of ships sort of pounding on one another. But it was a gruesome experience. And, you know, when Hood and Bismarck face off, you know, Bismarck sinks Hood and then turns her guns on Prince of Wales. And, you know, there's a part in the book where a shell goes through the bridge on Prince of Wales, and there's a young sailor on board who's 16 years old, and he's given a mop and he's told to go into the bridge and clean up the mess. And think about it, 16 years old, and he walks into the bridge and all he sees is human flesh and remains smeared all over the walls. It was a very visceral thing. Same thing with Saint-Nazaire. You know, these guys, sort of raid a French port, they're in wooden motor launches and they're being blasted at by anti-aircraft guns, and the devastation is, I mean, the violence on that raid was horrific. And, you know, you write about that stuff in the book, not because you're trying to, like, gross people out or because, you've got some sort of bloodlust, but you want to convey sort of the horrific nature of war. I think when you sit down to write a book like this, you don't want to romanticize it or make it look, you know, make it look fun. You want to convey as well as you can how horrible it was to be there, and to also sort of drive home what ordinary men and women were asked to do, you know, the incredible sacrifice they made and sort of the horrific experiences they went through.
Yeah, and I think especially given the, maybe it's the culture or the sensibilities of the time that the war took place, those depictions and descriptions weren't front and center. You know, those are stories that didn't come out till years later, or that weren't really widely known outside of the people who actually participated in them. So it kind of helps to color in the picture a little bit from, you know, our usual History Channel documentary style view of the war, I think.
Exactly. And, you know, when I was writing this book, Shawnee raised an interesting point, because, you know, some of the books I read while researching this book were written in the 1950s. I think one was written in the late 1940s. So they were published, you know, pretty soon after the events described. And what you realize when you read them is they're very whitewashed and they're very clean. Robert Ryder, who was the commander on the Saint-Nazaire raid, he wrote a book called The Raid on Saint-Nazaire. It's a short volume, and it came out, I want to say, in the early 50s. I can't remember the date exactly. But it gives a good framework of the raid. And he sort of kind of, you know, describes the action, but it doesn't in any way sort of detail the immense violence that these men went through. And sort of this, sort of tempest of fire. And so, you know, you really do have to look to sort of the firsthand accounts that were written. And I, you know, one thing, not with this book, but just from past experiences, when I've interviewed veterans from the war. You know, when I wrote a book years ago on the RAF, the one thing I found was the incredible reluctance of these men to talk about their experiences. You know, they didn't want to go into any detail about anything. And if they made some sort of comment, you know, if they did talk about it, they were very self-deprecating, like, oh, what's the big deal? All of us did it. So I think, you know, going back in time, you know, talking about it back then, if you went through it, might have been seen as bragging because everyone sort of did their bit. But I think as, you know, the years have worn on and, you know, records have become unclassified, and, you know, more firsthand accounts have come out, then, you know, we've been able to get a better picture of, you know, sort of just how brutal it was.
Yeah. And, well, we've mentioned the raid on San Jose a few times already, and I kind of wanted to talk about that a little more in depth.
Sure.
So, I mean, going into this book, had never heard of it and didn't know what it was. So, in a nutshell, it was essentially, I forget the, it was the Scharnhorst, which was docked in Norway.
It was actually the Tirpitz.
The Tirpitz, yeah.
So, yeah. First of all, it's funny, yeah, in the U.S., the San Jose raid doesn't get a lot of, coverage, or it's not talked about a lot. In the U.K., it's a big deal. It's considered, you know, some historians have called it the greatest raid of all time because it was, first of all, the plan was so crazy, and the men who took part, they were just stupefyingly brave when you look at what they did. And of all the things I write about in the book, Chariot is my favorite one. And for folks who don't know about it, it was a British commando raid on the port of Saint-Nazaire, which is home to the Normandy dry dock, which was the largest dock. It was the only dock on the European Atlantic coast large enough to hold a ship of Tirpitz's size. And Tirpitz is anchored in Norway away from RAF bombers. But the British are terrified that she's going to sail from Norway and make a break into the North Atlantic and, you know, cut across Britain's shipping lanes and sort of, you know, starve Britain to death. So what they do is they decide to deny Tirpitz safe harbor on the Atlantic coast by destroying this dry dock in Saint-Nazaire. And so Tirpitz won't have a base of operations should she try to break into the Atlantic. And the dock, it's huge. It's about 164 feet wide. It's 52 feet deep. You know, they can't bomb this thing away because, you know, they lack the means for precision bombing, and it's going to be impossible to sort of attack it, you know, through naval bombardment because the port sits 6 miles up the lower estuary. So what the British decide to do is they take an old destroyer, the HMS Campbelltown, and they load the bow of the boat with 24 depth charges. And they load the depth charges into steel drums, and they encase the steel drums in cement. So you got about 4 tons of concrete and explosives. And their plan is to sail this boat up the lower estuary under a German flag and ram it into the dry dock. And they put 80 commandos on board this boat. And the plan is that the boat will ram into the dock. The 80 commandos will jump off the boat, blow up a bunch of port facilities, because it was also a big U-boat pen, San Jose. You know, so the plan was they blow up a bunch of facilities in the port to make it useless. Sailing along with Campbelltown are 12 other motor launches, each motor launch with another raiding party of 15 commandos. They'll all jump ashore, do the damage, get back on the motor launches, head back to England, and then at, you know, 8 o'clock the following morning, Campbelltown will explode and the dock will be destroyed. What happens is their cover is blown, basically. You know, just a couple of miles from the port. They actually make it quite a ways up the estuary before their cover is blown, and they are exposed to absolute hellacious fire. And these motor launches that the commandos are riding on, these 12 motor launches, you know, they're made of wood, and their fuel tanks sit on top of the deck. So these motor launches are being shredded. Fuel tanks are exploding. You know, burning gasoline is spilling into the river. The river's catching on fire. Men are falling into the river. They had two embarkation points, disembarkation points for the San Jose raid. There was a pier where six motor launches were meant to dispatch their commandos. And then there was an area near the dry dock where another six motor launches were meant to dispatch their commandos. In the event, you know, only about 100 commandos get on shore. Most of the motor launches are absolutely shredded. Most of the crews are killed. They do manage to ram Campbelltown into the target. But what happens is the commandos actually make it on shore. They're stranded. There's no way to get home. And it turns into this all-night battle for survival. It's a really brutal slog. The fight spills out of the port and into the town of San Nazaire itself. And you know, I should add that the San Nazaire attack force, it was 611 men, and the port itself was defended by 6,000 Germans. So you get a sense of the odds. And it's a running gun battle all through the night and into the morning, when the surviving commandos eventually have to surrender because they run out of ammunition. But the fight during the night, it's building to building, it's through basements, it's a brutal encounter. The commandos are rounded up and shipped off to captivity. The Campbelltown does explode. I think it's like 9 o'clock the following morning. The blast is so big. It scatters body parts, but you know, like all through the town. One account I read said like a week later they were still finding arms and legs on roofs and buildings. At the time Campbelltown explodes, there are about 400 German officers inspecting the damage, looking at the ship. So they all go up in the blast, but they do knock the port out of use, or the dock out of use. So it does deny Tirpitz the base of operations for the Atlantic. So it was a success, and even the Germans, in the days after, there's a radio broadcast, and the radio announcer says, I'm sure every heart in Germany goes out to the courage of the British servicemen who carried out this audacious attack. And it was a great morale booster back in the UK. It's just an amazing story. Why it hasn't ever received sort of more attention on this side of the Atlantic, I don't know, because it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's the stuff of Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, it's got everything you need for a movie. And especially the way it's described in the book, there were a few times I had to kind of flip back and be, you know, say, okay, wait, which group of guys is this? Because it just seems like, with all the motor launches and the destroyer running up, it was chaotic even from the very beginning. Especially once they land, you know,
It was complete and utter chaos. Once the Germans figured out what was happening, any kind of sense of cohesive plan went out the window. And one of the things I read when I was researching the book from one of the participants, he just wrote this great thing where they were traveling up the estuary under a German flag. When the Germans realized what was happening, they pulled the German flag down and raised the Royal Navy flag, and this like cheer went up, all the men on the boats, and then they storm headlong into this hellstorm of fire. But once these commandos got onto dry ground, and the landings were vicious. The Germans had placed anti-aircraft batteries on the rooftops of the buildings in the harbor, which they could also use to aim at ground targets. And so these guys are coming under anti-aircraft fire, they're coming under machine gun fire. Once these guys got on the ground, I mean, there was no sort of cohesive plan. It was just, sort of try and do the job you were meant to do and survive. And the rule was, if any of your comrades are shot or injured, leave them. Time is of the essence. You can't hang about.
Yeah, I mean, if there was one word to describe this raid, I think it would just be balls. Because
that's probably the best word to describe. Again, when I was like, I'd known about the raid, and I'd read some stuff on it before, but when I sort of did the in-depth research, I just couldn't fathom. And there's a scene in the book which comes from one of the first-hand accounts that they had to keep this operation top secret, obviously. And so the men who took part, and I should say, out of the 611 men who took part, 169 were killed, 215 were taken POW, 227 make it back to the UK. Five actually make it back by foot. They make it through France, Spain, into Gibraltar, and then get back to the UK. But the men who took part in this operation, they went through all this training, but they weren't told what they were training for. And it's like 24 hours before the raid takes place, they're told what their mission is. And the commanding officer asks these guys, if you don't want to do this, I understand. I know some of you are married, some of you have kids. If you don't want to do it, raise your hand. No judgment. You're free to walk out and go. And no one raised their hand. And I read that and I was thinking, yeah, Jesus. Yeah, I probably would have my hand might have gone off.
Yeah.
sitting in the back of the room. Yeah.
Well, I guess that does kind of bring me to the next thing I want to discuss about it, which was really, was the juice worth the squeeze? I mean, it, as daring as it was, and it was successful, I mean, the amount of well-trained commandos that were lost, the sailors that were involved, there was a lot of talent, I guess you could say, that was lost from
a lot of talent
the
that
British
was
Army.
Lost. Yeah, and it's questionable whether or not, and of course, it's easy now to say, 2020 hindsight, looking back, right? But it's questionable whether or not the raid was necessary. Tirpitz was anchored in Norway. She wasn't really gonna go anywhere. Hitler was terrified of losing her, and he wasn't gonna expose her to any confrontation with the Royal Navy. Obviously, the British didn't know that at the time. I think it was probably worth it in the sense that it was a morale booster for the British. This happens in 1942. 1942 is a tough year for the Allies. Things aren't going well. So I think in terms of public perception, it was good. But the loss of these commandos and the resources used. My mind's blanking, but Admiral McRaven, obviously, who
I was going to bring that up at the end of the book. Include his small bit of his analysis.
Yeah. He sort of says that the planning for the raid, it was audacious, but it wasn't fully thought through. And he said, the number of men committed to the raid, he said, was ridiculously small for the task that they were going to do. And I think his sort of critiques of the operation were that the men spent too long on target. Their scope was too broad. The only thing that sort of saw these men through was their dedication to the job. And so he views it the same way. It was a great morale booster, but whether or not it actually served any purpose other than like bolstering British morale back home, is questionable.
Yeah. And I mean, but with a lot of,
it makes for phenomenal reading.
Oh, it definitely does. And I mean, and with anything involving, especially the British military in the World War II, you have to ask yourself how much of this was, especially something as high profile as this is, how much of this was because it was one of Churchill's personal priorities as opposed to something
That's a good point, because Churchill is obsessed with Tirpitz. He's actually obsessed with all four capital ships in this book. Churchill is obsessed with Tirpitz in particular. Really, just nags at him. I mean, he just wants this thing destroyed, and he was constantly, for lack of a better word, harassing his military chiefs. Like, what are you doing about Tirpitz? What have you done about Tirpitz? Where's Tirpitz? What have you done to what have you done this week to try and sink her? So I do think some of this was probably to appease Churchill's demands, but I also understand Churchill's concern. I mean, Britain, the fact it's an island serves it well in one point, in that it spares Britain from obviously the Blitzkrieg in the summer of 1940, but it leaves her obviously prone to blockade and starvation.
Yeah,
and
I think Churchill probably was desperate for a means to strike back at Hitler directly. He'd been caught up in the U-boat battle and these sort of very indirect attacks, and something like this maybe offered him some way of attacking directly.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, the commandos that took part in the San Jose raid, Churchill, the commandos were created from an order that, by Churchill himself, because Churchill knew that the British Army wasn't going to be returning to the continent in any meaningful form for a while. You know, Britain wasn't going to be launching an invasion of the continent by itself. But he wanted a way to sort of do these guerrilla attacks, you know, sort of guerrilla warfare raids, that sort of thing, on coastal targets, to sort of show Germany that Britain wasn't backing down, and also to give the people at home something to cheer about. And there had been a couple of commando raids before Saint-Nazaire, you know, against like some island outposts in Norway and a few other places. But this was like the first really big, big deal. And, you know, part of it was to show Germany that Britain wasn't lying down. You know, Britain and Germany were confined at that point to either slugging it out in the air, you know, battling it out on the sea. And, of course, there was the Desert War going on. But, you know, he wanted some offensive action closer to home, and Saint-Nazaire was it.
Yeah. Yeah. So to sort of shift gears here, the way I've kind of thought about the battle against especially the surface fleet of the Kriegsmarine, was that it was sort of anticlimactic, that it kind of petered out after the battle against the Bismarck. But I guess I didn't realize how those efforts to sink the Gneisenau, the Tirpitz, and the Scharnhorst continued throughout the war with some really daring raids. Was that a sense that, you know, this wasn't an anticlimactic thing? This was actually something that did not fizzle out from the beginning, or was this something you sort of realized as you were researching and writing?
No, I realized, you know, when I started writing this book, I wasn't sure, you know, how it was going to play out, what sort of the attitude of British commanders were. Obviously, I knew, let's put it this way, when I started writing, my thought was kind of the same as you. The Bismarck is, that's like the end-all be-all of sort of the war against the German surface fleet. And I mean, you know, the story of the Bismarck, that's like a tale of vengeance for the ages. It's a wonderful, dramatic story. But in researching the book, what came to light is that even after Bismarck was sunk, there was euphoria in the UK. There was a lot of, you know, Churchill was thrilled about it. But sort of as I kind of said earlier, his focus shifted to Tirpitz. You know, Tirpitz is just as big as Bismarck. In fact, Tirpitz, you undergo some modifications, and she's actually slightly larger than Bismarck. And so Churchill views her as a major risk, not only to British convoys, you know, convoys between the U.S. and Britain, and British convoys between, you know, the U.K. and you know, Britain's armies overseas, but also because she's anchored in Norway, he views her as a major threat to Russian convoys between from the U.K. And well, that was actually one thing that I learned that I did not know before I started writing this book, and that between August of 41 and May of 45, there are 78 Allied convoys between the U.K. and Russia, and they ship about, they provide Russia with about 4 million tons of supplies free of charge. And that by the end of 1941, a third, this was an interesting statistic, I had no idea, by the end of 1941, a third of the tanks on the Russian front were British tanks. And then the British were using American tanks from Lend-Lease to sort of fill in the gaps in their own sort of armored lines in North Africa. But the surface ships were a major threat throughout the war. Scharnhorst and Gneisenau are a threat because they are, you know, they spent a good part of the war anchored in Brest, you know, on the French Atlantic coast, where they have easy access to Britain's sea lanes. And Churchill was absolutely adamant that those ships get destroyed as well. So even after the United States enters the war, and, you know, it looks, you know, victory becomes more of a sure thing, the destruction of these ships remains imperative, because obviously, you know, Britain's still got to ship its armies overseas. You know, Britain still has to, you know, control the English Channel for, you know, D-Day. You know, supplies still have to come in for the American armies from the U.S. And these ships at any time can threaten sort of the arteries that provide all of that. So the threat was real and constant. And even in 1944, when Tirpitz is, you know, she's damaged catastrophically in one air raid, but she refuses. I mean, she's the boat that refused to sink. She takes an absolute beating constantly. I mean, the British try to sink her like 20 times from, it's like October 1940 to November 44 when they finally do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of remarkable the amount of punishment all of these ships take without sinking.
It's remarkable. It really shocked me when I was writing this book. I mean, you know, you read it like Scharnhorst. She gets blasted at one point. You know, she has like 1,000 tons of water flood into her lower compartments, and she still stays upright. You know, it's remarkable engineering. But even with Tirpitz mortally wounded in Norway and really not able to take part in any kind of wartime operations, even though the British knew this, they receive German radio intercepts. Churchill still wants her sunk, and he even writes to the heads of the Air Force and the Navy, and he says, you know, Tirpitz is a prize we need to claim, even if it means sort of more loss of British lives. We have to sink her. And I think one of the reasons for that too is she's a symbol of German military might. She's a symbol of Nazi hubris, and I think there was sort of a symbolic a symbolic victory too, and sort of getting rid of a ship like that.
Yeah, so I think that takes us to maybe the final point was the overall impact of the German surface fleet, and was Hitler right at the end of the book he gets in that argument with Admiral Raeder, saying, hey, these are just a drain on resources, that's the U-boat fleet that is what's really mm-hmm. gonna, if we're going to win this war, that's what's going to do it. These big, cool-looking battleships don't actually win us any battles.
Right. It's interesting. So the German surface fleet, it was a fleet that was, number one, hampered by impossible odds, right? Because there was no way it could take on sort of the Royal Navy head-on. In the beginning of the war, war's early years, the Royal Navy is the largest naval force on Earth. So the German surface fleet wasn't going to be able to sort of tackle that challenge. But at the same time, it cost so much in men and materials that it couldn't just simply sit in harbor looking good. And then, but at the same time, simply doing commerce raiding and sinking merchant ships it was almost a task like below its full potential. And so I think the effectiveness of the German surface fleet was as a psychological weapon. I think it was more of a psychological weapon than anything else. It inflicted a terror on British military, military commanders. Britain for the early years of the war was hanging on by its fingernails. It was holding the line. The war was Britain's to lose, and anything that threatened that had to be eliminated. Britain required 23 million tons of supplies a year coming across the Atlantic to keep it fighting. And so as long as these ships remained afloat, whether they were in harbor or anchored in Norway or whatever, they were a danger to British survival. So I think their war was psychological. That's not to say they didn't have an impact. Bismarck does inflict a really bloody wound on the British public with the sinking of Hood. They did have some moments, but I think all in all, they were a psychological weapon more than anything else. And the U-boats were the real actual physical menace.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you could probably have a very long conversation about the utility of the German surface fleet. They had the same problem in the First World War, where they had these big great battleships, but the one fleet they need to defeat, the Royal Navy, is the one that they're never going to be able to beat. It's the same story exactly. In the Second World War.
And what's interesting is Hitler, after the Battle of the Barents Sea, which was meant to take out a convoy that was, on its way to Russia, and the battle, doesn't go well for the Germans. Hitler orders, he basically wants the surface fleet program scrapped. And Grand Admiral Raeder, having, sort of lost Hitler's confidence, he resigns. And then what's interesting is, Dönitz, commander of the U-boats, he becomes Grand Admiral. He was actually against the surface fleet program to begin with, but he actually talks Hitler into sort of keeping some of their surface ships, because to scrap them all would hand the British, you know, an easy victory. And so, you know, the reason the program isn't, you know, the surface fleet isn't fully scrapped is because of, you know, Dönitz, you know, sort of arguing the case to at least keep Scharnhorst and Tirpitz anchored in Norway as a threat to Russian convoys and a deterrent to Allied invasion of Norway.
Yeah, I think there's, when it comes to the surface fleet engagements, especially in the Atlantic, that there's a lot of psychological untangling to do. I mean, so much of it seems to be that these ships exist sort of just to exist. The one tangible effect that it did seem to have is that, and you mentioned this in the book, is that the fact that the Scharnhorst was still docked in Norway kept the British home fleet home as opposed to fighting in the Far East or something where maybe it could have had a more tangible impact.
Yeah, Scharnhorst moves to Norway in 1943, and Tirpitz is already there. And then Scharnhorst is sunk on December 26, 1943. And Tirpitz becomes, she was dubbed the Lonely Queen of the North. You know, she's the last of Hitler's capital ships. And you know, she's there. And exactly, the British keep the bulk of their fleet tied down in northern waters, just out of fear that Tirpitz is going to sort of break into the Atlantic again. Once Tirpitz is sunk in 1944, you're right, then they, you know, they ship a bunch of ships, you know, over to the Pacific for the British Pacific Fleet. But yeah, it's amazing that one ship could have such an impact. So in a way, Tirpitz did serve a purpose, you know. It's funny, she only fired her guns in anger like once. She raids a Allied weather station in September 1943, and it's like the first or second time she fires her guns in an offensive action, and then she never, you know, other than like, you know, when she's attacked by bombers, she actually never takes part in any sort of naval action again.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, I mean, personally, I just am fascinated with just those big ships just from an engineering perspective, I guess you could say. And it's sort of disappointing that they never really go to toe-to-toe, except for the Bismarck and Hood and Prince of Wales. Exactly.
I feel the same way. I was actually thinking about it the other day, you know, because people are fascinated by these ships. I think, number one, because they are such, you know, immense, powerful machines, but also because they're such relics of the past. And I sort of think of kind of compared to people who are train enthusiasts, you know, they love the old-fashioned steam engines because they're, you know, beautiful design, but you know, that they're a relic of history. And I think that's sort of, that's kind of how I view these ships. And I think that's why their story remains, you know, so popular. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a World War II expert or a history geek to, you know, hear the names Bismarck, Hood, Tirpitz and know what someone's talking about. I mean, they've really sort of transcended time.
Yeah, and I mean, personally, anytime there's a description of, or just those rare events when actual battleships engaged each other, I think it only happened like half a dozen times throughout the whole Second World War when you actually had 15-inch guns firing at 14-inch guns and having that exchange, you know, and two of those are depicted here. You just have to cherish those because they're so few and far between.
It is, and it was an amazing spectacle. And you know, one of the occasions where that happens is the Battle of North Cape, where HMS Duke of York, you know, takes on Scharnhorst, and you know, these are two, you know, massive monsters of war. And one of the sailors on one of the accompanying cruisers, British cruisers, just said it was amazing watching these two ships basically sort of kind of smash each other, you know, pound each other relentlessly with these big guns. And, you know, the noise and the spectacle of it all was awe-inspiring, even to men who'd been through naval battles before. And, you know, it's kind of like Godzilla versus King Kong, right? It's like a clash of titans.
The last thing I would ask you is, what would you say the big takeaway is?
I think the big takeaway from this book is to come away with a respect for what ordinary people were asked to do and the sacrifice that ordinary people made for their country. You know, you read about these guys in the midget submarines who raided Tirpitz, or the, you know, flyers and the bombers and the freezing temperatures, you know, the sailors who went down in the frigid waters of the North Atlantic, you know, whether they, regardless of what side they were on, the sacrifice was immense. And it was a time when sort of ordinary people were asked to do extraordinary things, things that went beyond the limits of normal human endurance. And I think, you know, as the years pass, you know, we've got fewer World War II veterans around to sort of tell their stories. And so I think it's important that, you know, when these stories do come out, people pay attention to them and remember what was asked of that generation back then. And, you know, the greatest generation, you know, it is cliche, you know, greatest generation. But it is remarkable what these people were asked to do. And, you know, they answered the call and, you know, some of them paid a terrible price for it.
Definitely. And I think your passion for the subject matter and to tell these people's stories comes through on the page.
Anyway, I'd like to say it was a great conversation, Simon, and thanks for being on the show.
Hey, Sean, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.